all who are able are invited to stand for the reading of the gospel lesson. The gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to St. Mark. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they answered him, "John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah." And he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with his disciples, and he said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake, for the sake of the gospel, will save it. Or what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in glory, the glory of his Father with the holy angels. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever, the gospel of the Lord." You may be seated. Next year, in August, it'll mark the 70th anniversary of the death of a young man who was from Chicago, visiting relatives in Mississippi. He was dragged from the house of his great uncle, taken by two white men who tortured him before shooting him and dumping him in the Tallahatchie River. August 28th, 1955, Emmett Till died. Actually, Emmett Till was killed. Falsely accused of whistling at a white woman in a general store, the wife of one of the men who ultimately murdered him. A horrific, if all too common, story in the South during the first two-thirds of the 20th century. So while I want to be honest about what's happened in the past, I also want to be sensitive because I know that people still carry the wounds of this horrific period of time in our country's history. At the time, these sorts of violent crimes against African Americans were a common way of warning black people to stay in your place. And therefore, they didn't usually receive much media attention. Indeed, the silence of white churches at the time sent its own bat signal to black people that they couldn't even count on their white siblings in Christ, a sin for which the church has not, in my estimation, sufficiently confessed or atoned after all these years. There's no question that the murder of Emmett Till might have gone unnoticed, except by those closest to the crime, if it weren't for one person, his mother, Mamie Till Bradley. She made the decision to have an open casket. Of course, the decision was controversial because those who murdered young Emmett Till rendered his body unrecognizable. But Mamie Till Bradley later said, "There was just no way I could describe what was in that box, no way. I just wanted the world to see." Tens of thousands of people, mostly black, gathered at the A.A. Rayner Funeral Home in Chicago to pay their respects, to witness the racist brutality against a young black man. 14, he was. Crime, of course, was terrifying, and it affected all black people. Mamie Till let Jet Magazine photograph her son's body. Now, the photographs were subsequently published in both Jet Magazine and in the black newspaper, the Chicago Defender. In fact, a picture of Mamie Till Bradley hovering over the body of her son was later published in Time Magazine. So the photos in the Chicago Defender ignited fury among the city's black population. Jet and Time Magazine's decision to publish the pictures gave the rest of the country a rare glimpse of the unspoken horror and savagery suffered by black people in our country. See, Emmett Till's murder and the public nature of his funeral sparked, in many ways, the civil rights movement. This movement gave us titans of justice like Rosa Parks and Medgar Evers, Fannie Lou Hamer, Malcolm X, John Lewis, Diane Nash, Martin Luther King Jr. All of that led to historic acts like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 or the Voting Rights Act of 1965. One young man and the courage of a mother. Now, funerals with open caskets are fairly common. I've participated in funerals where, despite the condition of the body and the counsel of the funeral director, people have insisted on having an open casket. But Emmett Till's open casket wasn't just a part of a ceremony. Because of the social climate at the time, marked by the ever-present resentments of hundreds of years of exploitation and abuse of black people, that act meant inestimably more. It carried a symbolic meaning that launched a revolution. Mamie Till knew what she was doing. Some acts aren't just acts. I mean, they have much more significant meaning. Her words, "I just wanted the world to see," were an act of faith that if the world were just confronted with the truth of its sin, it would finally have to acknowledge that truth. Her decision to display her son's body, to tell the truth about how the world treats the vulnerable and the exploited, would subject her to the glaring spotlight of public attention and focus hatred of much of the rest of white America on her. It cost her the life she had by picking up a cross that I guarantee you nobody wants to pick up. Mamie Till knew all that, knew it could cost her everything, but she decided to lay down that easy life of silence, to lose her life of quiet anonymity so that the world would finally see its offense against those it chose for so long to keep conveniently hidden. Now, I believe Jesus, in our passage for today, would understand Mamie Till's decision. In the first 8 chapters of Mark, Jesus, we find him in different places, strange locations, among strange people. And that in itself makes its own kind of theological statement about the reign of God and who's welcome. That's the first 8 chapters. The next 8 chapters find Jesus eventually arriving after a journey in Jerusalem, a not-so-strange place populated by the powerful and the influential. Now, the contrasts are fascinating because Jesus spends the first part of Mark's gospel in Nebraska and then takes a fateful journey to Washington, D.C. See, our text for today stands at the threshold, the point at which, in Mark's gospel, Jesus makes the first move on his journey to Jerusalem. He's been here, now he's going there. Now, of course, we've read the final chapter, so we know what happens when Jesus finally gets to Jerusalem, right? As did Mark's readers. So it's difficult to read our text for today without some sense of foreboding. This is the cinematic sweep where the intense music begins to play. Now, we know what it will ultimately cost Jesus as he makes this final prescient speech to his disciples, and so we cover this challenging passage again. Because somewhere at the center of it all, we confess through our exposure to this story, we confess who Jesus is and therefore who we are now because of it. Our gospel this morning looms as a constant reminder of what is at stake in all of our faith. The cross stands at the end of the journey for Jesus, and it is the cross that Jesus commands his disciples to take up. Now, according to Mark, Jesus knew as he walked down the narrow path that day that there was no way for him to be faithful to God's purposes and avoid that cross. He knew that his challenge of the powerful on behalf of the powerless, I mean, it couldn't help but appear threatening to the people in charge. I mean, he knew the special kind of death that had been reserved for other failed messiahs, for those who would presume to challenge Caesar's might. See, Jesus isn't talking about some subjective experience here, some inconvenience like being nearsighted or having an uncle who's an overbearing loudmouth that nobody wants to sit next to at Thanksgiving dinner. The cross that Jesus is talking about, that we must bear if we are to follow him, is something that we decide to bear, that we choose. It is something we take up, not some physical infirmity. It's not our aches and pains. It's not the inconveniences that life presents us with. No, indeed, to take up our cross and follow Jesus is a voluntary thing. It's not something that gets thrust upon us by genetics or by lack of aptitude or just sheer bad luck, all of which are things we have no control over. See, the crosses that we bear, like Jesus before us, have to do with the consequences that we suffer in determining not to stay silent in the face of injustice, with the pain and the suffering we embrace as those who try to live by, like Jesus, by saying yes to the vulnerable and the exploited while saying no to those who operate the machinery of death and domination. As theologian James Cone points out, we cannot find liberating joy in the cross by spiritualizing it, by taking away its message of justice in the midst of powerlessness, suffering, and death. The cross, as a locus of divine revelation, is not good news for the powerful, for those who are comfortable with the way things are, or for anybody whose understanding of religion is aligned with power. According to James Nere, crucifixion was an institution of humiliation, torture, and execution, and it was designed to deal with the people who were considered most threatening to the establishment and its interests. In other words, the cross was something people got nailed to as a form of capital punishment for being political subversive, for being those unwilling to remain silent in the face of oppression. According to Friedrich Nietzsche, Christianity won its biggest PR battle by convincing people that moral good consists of things like kindness and piety and humility, all of which he identifies as the last refuge of the powerless, the impotent. The perfect symbol for this morality of the weak, Nietzsche believed, is the cross. He said it has a debilitating narcotic power. It is a ghastly paradox of a crucified God. In the cross, he lamented, is the certainty that the pacifism of Jesus has by now triumphed over all other noble values. See, Nietzsche saw that the power of Christianity didn't come from claiming power or by trying to be the boss by deposing the boss. Instead, he understood that following Jesus is about the vulnerability of serving the vulnerable, the highest demonstration of which comes in the cross. More accurately than many Christians, Nietzsche realized that at the very heart of Christianity sits this cross, which is a preference for what appears to the world to be nothing more than weakness. Peace over violence, gentleness over cruelty, welcome over exclusion, love over hatred. Now, Nietzsche and I agree on the analysis. Where Nietzsche and I disagree isn't over whether this is true, but whether this vulnerability is a good thing or a bad thing. See, followers of Jesus think that vulnerability that comes with serving those who are themselves exposed and powerless, that's what makes us more human, not less. That's what makes us more moral, not less. But he is right, Nietzsche. The cross has been seen throughout history not as an invitation to an adventure, but often as a kind of domesticated symbol of stability, an ode to resignation and acquiescence. But see, it's possible that in domesticating the cross, we can no longer sense its either its offensiveness or the glory that comes with it. See, in today's text, Jesus not only says he's walking toward the cross, but he also invites us to go with him. He promises us that where the crucified are, that's where he's going to be. Now, if we're following Jesus, we're walking toward the cross, but we're not walking that path alone. The call is to take up our crosses and follow Jesus. With Jesus. Together. Us. He's already walked down that road toward the cross, but he walks it again and again whenever the faithful bear their cross, challenging the oppressor on behalf of the oppressed. Because having borne it before, he's able to bear it with us. So is today's text good news or bad news? Right? I mean, it sounds like bad news. The worst of all possible news in a society where pain and sacrifice are avoided. The cross disabuses us of the simplistic notion that the meaning of life revolves only around pleasure, around getting my needs met the way I think they need to be met. But what if the cross, with all that bad news of suffering and sacrifice, actually contains within it some good news? What if our decision to lay down our lives and take up that cross as fearsome and terrifying as it is the very place where we finally meet Jesus. Moreover, being near Jesus puts us near the vulnerable and the exploited. That's good news. Since we've embraced the cross, we've already embraced vulnerability and powerlessness. Not as a strategy for effective living, but as a way of life that seeks only to give to Jesus the lives that he asks to bless and protect. We don't have to wonder any longer whether we have any responsibility for our siblings, those who can't stand up any longer by themselves. We don't have to ask. We no longer need to ask whether those who've been forgotten or abused or kicked to the curb, whether they're our people or not. We don't have to ask. Through the grace of the cross, we're able to see not competitors in a food chain, not threats to our own individual projects and goals, not nuisances for which we have neither the time nor the energy, but we see before us family. That's what we see. We see family everywhere we look. Ethel Gill said that one of the most profound paradoxes of Christianity is to be found in the fact that the one who was not able to carry his own cross is the one who is able, who enables us to carry ours. The cross is an optional equipment for the journey of faith. It's not a premium add-on. But we don't have to bear it alone. Indeed, we do not bear our crosses alone. But they are crosses. And as I've said before, as Father Daniel Berrigan famously pointed out, if you want to follow Jesus, you better look good on wood. Jesus knew. Mamie Till knew. There are some things worth losing your life for.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Douglas Boulevard Christian Church Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please rate the podcast on iTunes, retweet the link, or just tell your friends. Godspeed until next time on the Douglas Boulevard Christian Church Podcast.